Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight to the Sydney Institute for our second function of the year. Our program is down there. I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. He's well known to all of you. Commissioner McKelty was educated at Charles Sturt University and the University of Virginia. He has an extensive career with the Australian Federal Police and other related crime prevention bodies in and outside Australia. He was appointed Deputy Commissioner of the AFP in 2001, and he's been Commissioner of the AFP since 2001. I think there's some problem here. I don't know who wrote these notes, but... Before introducing the Commissioner, I should just also say thanks to Barry O'Farrell, who made it possible for us to get this fine facility today, and thanks to the people in Parliament House, New South Wales, who helped. Commissioner Kilty, you're most welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared, and thank you for the opportunity to come and address you. At the outset, I'd acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we're having this address this afternoon, and also acknowledge their elders past and present and their connection to the land. I want to talk today about policing terrorism, and it's a new paradigm for us, particularly here in Australia, because as yet we are yet to have a terrorist attack on our own soil. And if I talk more broadly about law enforcement, it's occurring in a constantly changing environment. It was not that long ago that police were primarily focused on the investigation of crimes after they were committed. Modern policing today is more focused on crime prevention, as it should be. And I dare to express that there are high levels of expectation upon our police, and rightly so, to focus on the prevention of crime rather than respond to crime after it's been committed. It's a reasonable expectation to have. And to be successful in this endeavour, it is important for us to minimise the distractions and focus on the job at hand. And that's not always an easy task, but as an organisation, the AFP remains open to change, open to new ways of doing things, and open to opportunities to learn. We do not know for certain what the future holds, but it is vital that we attempt to plan rather than being overwhelmed by it. In fact, in November last year, we hosted the International Policing Towards 2020 conference in Canberra. That conference brought together international and domestic delegates from law enforcement, government, business, academia and the community to discuss the future and what it might bring in terms of law enforcement. We analysed how that might affect global societies seeking to maintain law and order, and how to prevent and deter crime and enforce laws in a new world order. At the conference, we heard from a diverse field of experts such as futurists, economists, environmentalists, political scientists, social researchers, academics and international experts, as well as demographers. We discussed the future direction of law enforcement, and it's acutely clear to me that demands of the next decade will be significantly different from the demands of the previous decade. 2020 is only 12 years away, 12 years that I'm sure will pass with a blink of an eye. And that demands of us that we position ourselves to provide government with sound advice as to the likely policy and crime challenges as we understand them to be. It is not enough for us now to keep responding after issues emerge, with governments left on the back foot, as it were. For example, in the AFP, we created the International Deployment Group. It was a proactive step towards overcoming the impact upon not only the AFP, but our state and territory counterparts when required to provide police on an ad hoc basis to international interventions such as East Timor, the Sudan, Afghanistan and the Solomon Islands. Today, we are still the only police organisation in the world to have created such a standing capacity to respond to the request of our government to such interventions. However, while it is incumbent upon us to think and act in this way, we need to remember that criminals never cease devoting time and effort to reviewing the methods they use to commit crime. Criminals will continue to look for new markets where they can commit their crime, and they will continue to study our methodologies as they are, quite properly, scrutinised by the courts. The International Policing Towards 2020 conference provided a valuable forum for us to analyse our strengths and weaknesses, and just as importantly, to listen to other perspectives about the future of law enforcement. The opening words of Abraham Lincoln's famous House Divided speech of 1858 encapsulates this sentiment: if we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we could better judge what to do and how to do it. Last year, some commentators used the media to criticise the AFP's perceived lack of street smarts when it comes to interviewing terrorist suspects, because, it was suggested, we've all been too busy in the AFP earning degrees to have gained the street smarts to be able to have the hands-on experience to conduct such investigations. I make no apology for the recruitment of and further development of our police. Education is the cornerstone of a robust, modern and adaptable police force. We take every opportunity in the AFP to encourage our members to further their own education, whether it be for personal development and achievement, or whether it be as part of career development. It is sometimes suggested that in the AFP all we do is drug, tax and fraud investigations. If that were true, I'd probably have a few less grey hairs emerging. But those sort of comments really reveal a considerable lack of insight and knowledge about the roles, functions and responsibilities of the AFP. The AFP currently has more than 6,500 staff who work in a diverse range of fields. Combined with our homeland duties, we have officers working overseas in liaison, peacekeeping and capacity building roles. In fact, peacekeeping and regional assistance missions have evolved into one of our core business areas, and they remain an important way of strengthening links with the international law enforcement community. An integral aspect and long-term benefit of peacekeeping activities is that by helping our neighbours in the region to stabilise and establish law and order in their own communities, those police forces will become much stronger partners in preserving the peace, stability and good government of the region. This in turn should improve the environment for other whole of government agencies such as health and education to provide their expertise and assistance. While the AFP does undertake drug, tax and fraud investigations, and I might add with some degree of success, we also police Australia's major airports, we investigate high-tech crimes through the Australian High-Tech Crime Centre, we provide protective security services to the Commonwealth, including Commonwealth assets, critical infrastructure and diplomatic missions and high office holders, and we investigate transnational crimes like narcotics and people trafficking. We fight crime offshore through the AFP's international network, and we provide a community policing service to the people of the Australian Capital Territory. The AFP has earned a strong reputation for innovation and excellence, traversing new terrain in countering crime growth areas such as high-tech and transnational crimes. In fact, our experience and expertise in areas such as forensics and technical investigations are on demand throughout the world. The demand for our services was a direct result to responses to natural disasters such as the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2003 and the terrorist bombings in Indonesia. But interestingly enough, it's our counter-terrorism role domestically that has caused the most controversy. There has been some debate recently about the tension, whether real or perceived, between the right to silence and a fair trial, and the right of the community to access information. In a liberal democracy like Australia's, that tension is not resolved by denying one or the other of these rights. Instead, we resolve it by delaying the enjoyment of our right to free expression until after a person who has been charged with a crime has fully exercised the right to a fair trial and the presumption of innocence has run its appropriate course. In the United Kingdom, to provide a contrast with Australia, contempt of court laws prevent journalists from reporting proceedings in an open court. In fact, even reporting information that has previously been in the public domain might also not be exempt from contempt of court laws. Although in the UK there is debate around when exactly proceedings become active, it is understood to be at the time a person is arrested, a warrant is issued for the arrest of a person, or a person is charged with a crime. This media blackout remains in place until after the case is disposed of, abandoned, or discontinued or withdrawn. I'm not saying that correct processes and procedures should be cast aside, nor should public institutions be immune from public accountability in the discharge of their public service. But I am saying that a public discussion about them should be delayed in deference to judicial processes, not subjugated, not quashed, not silenced, just delayed until the full gamut of judicial process has been exhausted. If charges are laid, the right of the alleged offender to the presumption of innocence should take precedence over the public interest in knowing how the investigation was conducted and a person's right to freely discuss elements of the crime and its investigation. Information about the investigation and wider discussion about elements of the crime become available as part of the open court processes or after the legal process has been completely exhausted. Before I'm being accused of being a hypocrite, let me point out that in Operation Pandanus, where we've charged a number of people in Victoria and New South Wales with terrorism offences, we took the time to distance ourselves from the media attention and instead pointed out that unless handled sensitively, we could damage our relationships with the community. I understand that it can be difficult to wait for the chance to freely express ourselves, but I do believe to best serve the public interest and to attain the full enjoyment of all our rights, we must sometimes delay that expression. It's a tough choice, and I understand that. But ask yourself this. If you were charged with a crime, wouldn't you want to exercise your right to the presumption of innocence? Wouldn't you expect to receive a fair trial? Would you want objective, untainted, and dispassionate arbiters of your guilt or innocence in your jury of peers? I think this is a right each and every one of us would demand under such circumstances. One of the biggest challenges we face is the acute need to manage risk. In policing, in the AFP and also in the state and territory police that work with us in terrorism matters, we must balance the needs of preventing an incident from occurring against the need to have gathered as much evidence as possible to ensure successful prosecution. As a result, we intervene in a terrorist matter earlier than we normally would in other criminal investigations. This sometimes means that the subsequent prosecutions can be difficult and protracted because we are dealing with the elements of a conspiracy, which often relies on circumstantial evidence. I should add that terrorism is not the only crime in which we intervene prematurely to prevent people from becoming victims. For example, in child sex and sex slavery matters, we also give primacy to the welfare of the victim over a successful prosecution. But where we are publicly accused of a wrongdoing or a perceived inefficiency, it is appropriate to correct the record in order to maintain the confidence of the community and the government. There has been a disturbing trend developing where we have to apportion blame to somebody when things seemingly don't go the way some commenters think they ought to go. I would argue that the AFP is able to move with the times because of the culture of our people and the calibre of their people. Over the years, each new generation of AFP members has demonstrated a strong commitment to the organisation's crime-fighting objectives and an ability to adapt to changing needs. In fact, it's our strength. I'd also argue that the best person to interview a terrorist suspect is someone with a combination of skills, someone who has the street smarts but also a formal education and appropriate experience. As I've said, counter-terrorism investigations are complex. They require multifaceted, multi-jurisdictional and multi-agency approach. These are terms that almost too easily roll off the top of the tongue. It takes time and effort to balance everybody's expectations, whether they're the governments, whether they're the agencies, another agency, or whether they're the communities. I'll give you a timely example of what I mean. At the AFP, we are working hard to improve our members' understanding of and interaction with the Muslim community. We run Islamic awareness courses across Australia, which cover diverse topics such as the history of Islam, cultural sensitivities, and radicalisation influences. As well, the course also includes visits to local mosques and meetings with members of the Muslim community. In fact, I regularly meet with members of the Muslim community in every state of Australia, and I come here to Sydney quite often to speak on Muslim radio programs, including Talkback. Australia is at a crossroads right now. One of the tragedies of our modern world is that some members of our community regard each other with heightened suspicion. Some young Muslims have felt marginalised from the wider community. To me, we have a choice. We can marginalise the Muslim community by making adverse public comments, and I'm obviously not talking about the radical ones here, or we can make a concerted effort to work together. There is no doubting that world events can challenge our ability to work together in a very fundamental way, but despite that, it is important that we come together to help strengthen our relations between Muslims and non-Muslims. In the AFP, we have formed an Islamic liaison team. It's an initiative that hosts events with the local Muslim communities in an effort to reduce the mistrust and misconceptions between the AFP and Muslims. In fact, the AFP, during the recent fasting of Ramadan, hosted an iftar, which is the breaking of the fast, in Melbourne, which was attended by more than 300 people from the Muslim community and youth groups. Feelings of social isolation, difficulties integrating with the community, can contribute to making individuals susceptible to radicalisation. The Islamic liaison team is working hard to improve social cohesion with the Australian community. We're not alone in this endeavour. Other Australian police organisations are putting significant effort into this type of program. We are particularly keen to see the AFP expand our multicultural activities through the recruitment strategies and increase the number of Middle Easterners in the AFP. This would not only reflect the broader Australian community, but necessarily break down existing communication barriers. But it does not stop here. To be a successful police force, our police force must be representative of the community it serves. And I'm the first to admit that we in the AFP have struggled in the area of Indigenous recruitment and retention, but we still continue to work hard to overcome that. I am confident that after decades of serving offshore, whether as liaison officers in any of the 30 countries in which we serve, or through that international deployment group I mentioned earlier, that we have created in the AFP a critical mass of foreign-speaking and culturally experienced police. Despite our best efforts, however, I long ago came to expect that some people will criticise us no matter what we do and no matter how we do it. In fact, the Sydney Institute's last guest of 2007, the Reserve Bank Governor Glenn Stevens, lamented during his entertaining address that some media accounts of his public statements were not always in accord with his spoken words, and that some journalists had perfected the art of reading between the lines. I sympathise with the Governor. In fact, I was fortunate enough to lunch with the board after its last meeting last year. For most people, their sole source of knowledge regarding the AFP's counter-terrorism investigations is in the mass media. As such, it would be perfectly understandable if they mistakenly thought or held the belief that the AFP has failed the community. These are the facts. 30 people have been charged with terrorism-related offences in Australia. So far, 2 people have been convicted and sentenced. Next month, the trials of 22 people charged with a range of terrorism offences, including directing the activities of a terrorist organisation, recruiting for a terrorist organisation, providing funds or support to a terrorist organisation, and doing an act in preparation for a terrorist attack, will commence in Sydney and in Melbourne. I'm not going to comment further on those cases because I do not want to prejudice in any way those defendants' rights to a fair trial. Australians will be able to learn more about the details of the case as the evidence is tested, which is the most appropriate way to find out. The statistics on terrorism arrests do not include overseas successes in which the AFPs participated in an integral way, and these include arrests of people in Indonesia and also the Philippines. Last October, I delivered the inaugural Ray Whitrod Oration in Adelaide. And in my speech, I mentioned a number of potential security issues being studied by the AFP as part of our ongoing process of planning for the future. One of the issues I raised was climate change and how it could potentially pose the greatest threat to our border security that we've ever seen if, and I repeat if, some of the predicted impacts of climate change were to eventuate. But if some of the media stories following my speech were to be believed, you could have been forgiven for thinking that I had predicted some apocalyptic annihilation of humankind. As I stated earlier, despite the criticisms of the media, I still think it's important for us to think and plan for the future. Climate change, like many other potential issues to threaten our security, is something I believe an Australian community expects the AFP to look at. The reporting on terrorism matters has produced an interesting mix, with police roundsmen reporting on political events and political reporters reporting on police methodology, which hitherto has not been their area of interest. The mass media has a legitimate and valuable role to perform in Australia, that of informing the public. But routine matters are being mistakenly misrepresented, such as the difference between, for example, a bail application, a committal hearing and a trial. There's also a very significant difference between someone being found not guilty of an offence and an application for a nolle prosequi. This is not to mention the plethora of opinion writing, where opinion writers' knowledge of the subject matter is restricted to the newfound position of reporting from behind the safety fence of responsibility. Unfortunately, these opinion writers write as if they were still within the inner sanctum and understood all the details to be offered. I'm reminded here of John Doyle's Andrew Olley media address in 2005, where he said, and I paraphrase it because I have to, you can imagine John Doyle, "Suddenly the world is awash with opinion. Any half-baked idiot who can string a few sentences together is given a go, particularly if the opinion is inflammatory or somehow ratchets up the climate of fear or loathing, simply and obviously because it sells more newspapers." In some ways, it is understandable. There has been a discernible shift towards campaigns being run in the media to engender support for accused persons or persons under investigation. And I'm not only talking about terrorism matters here. There have been some notable cases in the past 5 years, and as one editor of a recently demised publication unashamedly put it to me, if he sells more magazines by having the front page of an accused person on his magazine, what's my problem with the story being run in the media and the defence being run in the media? We've actually seen now freedom of information material being used as a means of advancing cases in the court of public opinion. If that's what the community wants and expects of its criminal justice system, then we should all simply move on. But I wonder whether it's been a conscious decision by the wider community to abandon our criminal justice system in this way. Police forces introduced video and audio records of interview with suspects to engender and to ensure greater transparency and accountability. Consequently, there has been a significant decline, almost elimination, of allegations of verballing. There's also been a great reduction in the length of trials. But we are now witnessing these records of interviews being given to the media to add weight to the public campaigns being run. Whatever you think of this practice, it defeats the purpose for which video and audio records of interview were introduced. And it begs the question as to who decides what should or should not be leaked to the media, and where does that and to whom does that decision become accountable? When a record of interview is given to the media with accompanying commentary, we run the risk of jeopardising the accused's ability to receive a fair trial when the matter reaches the court. It is also only one part of a greater body of evidence, and when considered in isolation, it may serve as a public relations tool in the short term, but it has the potential to severely harm a case in the longer term. Call me old-fashioned, but I don't believe anyone accused of or charged with a crime can receive a fair trial if the matter is tested first in the court of public opinion. The element of secrecy is a characteristic of the environment in which terrorism investigations are conducted. In almost every terrorism investigation, there will be international linkages or involvement, whether direct or indirect. It's simply the nature of that crime. Often, some of the material we access during the course of an investigation belongs to foreign countries and is made available to us with strict caveats preventing its public release in Australia. We can sometimes forget that the whole of the Australian community derives a benefit from not only close international police cooperation, but also cooperation between intelligence agencies. There are often dividends to those relationships that are overlooked in the commentaries. Ironically, many of the issues I have raised are only available for public debate because of the transparency and accountability that exists in our Australian community. It does not exist everywhere in the world. And this is the real conundrum of this environment: balancing rights and powers. It will always be a challenge to get the equilibrium right, but let's not forget that it is these freedoms that we want to enjoy and protect for the whole community. In times when I find myself not in complete agreement with the conclusions reached by some members of the press, I try to remember the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, let me never fall into the vulgar mistake of dreaming that I am persecuted whenever I am contradicted. The now familiar chorus of calling for people to be sacked every time there is a difference of view has two long-term impacts. The first is that good people who would otherwise do an outstanding job for the community may be deterred from taking up positions of responsibility. And the second is that we risk permanent damage to public institutions when we actually need strong public confidence in those institutions. Unfortunately, we are sometimes forced into the public domain at times we would prefer not to be, such as during an ongoing investigation where false or misleading evidence finds its way into the media. On the other hand, we do not comment during ongoing investigations to avoid jeopardising the integrity of the investigation and any subsequent court proceedings. But on the other hand, by not responding, we risk the erosion of confidence from the community in governments, the police and the intelligence agencies. There are significant consequences from such erosions that are not always apparent. The erosion of trust is exacerbated where there are existing tensions in the community. People who oppose the government's terrorism policies can be used as a resource to erode confidence in the government, the police and the intelligence agencies. In fact, I can tell you with some degree of confidence that for every positive or factual statement I make, the usual suspects will be trotted out to voice their opposition, and I can almost tell you what they'll say. The best example I can give you of this is the recent launch here in Sydney of the AFP and New South Wales Joint Counter-Terrorism Facility. Only three journalists turned up to the media launch. One reporter didn't file any story at all, and the headlines from the other two reporters were one, Kelty attacked for court testing, and police reveal fresh terrorism threats came from the other reporter. You could never imagine when you read the articles that the two journalists were at the same function. As a consequence, a perception begins to build about the lack of independence between the government, the police, the prosecutors and the courts. And we can't afford to have that. When the community begins to perceive that tensions exist between police, the courts and the intelligence agencies, it's counterproductive to our true aims. The erosion of trust and the loss of support for our institutional governance and court is precisely what our adversaries want. If the situation becomes intractable, there are no obvious circuit breakers. One suggestion I can offer is to establish a society of editors or a similar body who can be addressed by the head of an institution in a not-for-publication forum. I read with interest such an address given by the head of MI5 in the UK, Jonathan Evans, to the UK Society of Editors in November last year. And interestingly enough, he spoke at a conference, the topic for which was a matter of trust. The proliferation of the internet as a communications tool has resulted in a situation where almost everyone can post information online, whether it's fact or whether it's fiction. Most newspapers in Australia, and indeed around the world, have an online presence in the internet today. And in the race to be the first media outlet to break a story, journalists compete to post breaking news online. Nothing wrong with that. But as such, a story is posted to their website as quickly as possible with minimal content, and therefore sometimes with minimal fact-checking, which is then built upon and expanded online over time as the story unfolds. The advent of sites such as Wikipedia create new opportunities for publication with seemingly little accountability. And again, here I'm reminded in the same speech by John Doyle and his observations that the internet allows anyone anywhere to access information that might be true, might be false. But you can find whatever information you need to prosecute any argument you want. Conspiracy theories abound. Most of the time it's not a problem, but once false or misleading stories are posted online, it becomes increasingly difficult to have them removed or corrected. In fact, I addressed over 100 Supreme Court and Federal Court judges here in Sydney last week, and I think it was a revelation that some of the corrections that they make to their online findings, unless connected to the original finding, can remain uncorrected, you know, ad infinitum. And this difficulty is compounded when so-called bloggers post online what they purport to be news. The issue is exacerbated when false or misleading reporting information online is then referenced elsewhere. And I wonder about and speak to journalists about whether they see this as an erosion of their own principles, professional ideals and ethics. And in fact, I think it'd be interesting to look back upon this period 10 years from now to understand its impact. In conclusion, the AFP is committed to protecting the Australian community in accordance with our ministerial direction, and we'll try to maintain the integrity of what we do and how we do it. Because in the AFP, as with any police force, without our integrity intact, we will simply lose the confidence of the community, the government, the courts, and in fact, the media. It is for this reason that we treat our information very carefully. Interestingly, we are one of the very few police forces in the world that has criminal sanctions for the unlawful release of information. And unlike many of our critics, we welcome our levels of accountability, and also unlike many of our critics who face no sanctions for getting it wrong, we will seek to correct the record when the need arises. The Rudd government has announced a judicial inquiry into the Haneef matter. For the record, we absolutely welcome such an inquiry. And in fact, we initiated our own inquiry, headed by former Justice Sir Lawrence Street, on issues that were raised by Justice Adams during the voir dire of a recent trial, resulting in an application by the Commonwealth DPP to nolly the matter. Today, policing is very much about building networks, particularly with our international colleagues, but also means traversing the nuances of international but also domestic diplomacy. It has become immensely important to understand the complexities of the broader political, social and economic environments in which we operate. And despite the continually changing and evolving nature of policing, there is something that will always remain constant. The AFP will always strive for transparency to government and to the community. We will continue to adapt to new roles and responsibilities, and we will continue to achieve it while remaining apolitical. Thank you.
Just stay there. Many thanks to the Commissioner. So we come to questions and discussion time. As usual, we take questions from members of the Sydney Institute here tonight on the topic of the talk, Terrorism, Policing's New Paradigm. And we'll conclude no later than 7 o'clock, but possibly before 7 o'clock. Can I just lead off, Commissioner? You mentioned the forthcoming Operation Pendennis cases in Melbourne and Sydney starting next month. You've spoken here tonight very much as head of the Australian Federal Police, but I guess in many of these policing matters you're working very much with the State and Territory Police. To what extent these days are these AFP operations, or to what extent are they combined operations in these kind of cases?
They're very much a combined operation, Gerard. After September 11 and importantly, after the first Bali bombing in October 2002, I put it to the then group of commissioners that we ought to establish joint counter-terrorism teams in every capital city. That's been done. It's funded by the Commonwealth. We try to operate, obviously, as jointly as possible. One of the things that is important is the proper handling of intelligence material and also and evidence. But just as we do in drug and other operations, we give primacy to the proper jurisdiction. So if an investigation goes down a path where it's most appropriate to use state charges, then obviously we would adopt that role. Alternatively, if it's the Commonwealth, then we would adopt that role. But I think all of us realise that a terrorist attack in Australia would be aimed at the policies and the stance taken by an Australian government, not necessarily a council or a state government. I think you have to look at the definition of terrorism to understand what it means. And one of the things I haven't mentioned here is that inherently it is political. If the definition of terrorism is to use force to create fear, to force or intimidate a government to change its stance or its position on a policy issue, then it's inherently political. And I think that is one of the issues that's creating difficulty for us.
Okay, so there's a question here.
To what extent has the AFP managed to determine how the terrorists finance their operations? I'm asking that question because the last few years I had about 18 email contacts offering me millions of dollars if I give them certain type of information. I wrote to the AFP three or four times telling them, you know, what could be
okay,
done about
we're gonna,
it.
Yeah.
And the reply was, we cannot do anything about it. Now, that was a few years ago. In the meantime, have you made progress in that?
Obviously, the financing of terrorism is a proactive step to prevent terrorism, and it's a big focus of our work, a very big focus of our work internationally. One of the difficulties, of course, is discerning when you look at the millions upon millions of dollars that are transacted every day and, in fact, remitted to or from a country every day, it is difficult to discern which are legitimate and which are illegitimate transactions. And it not only relates to terrorism, that relates to other forms of crime as well. It is a big area of focus, but the point I'm making to you is it is a very difficult and complex area in which to work.
I take my emails up with the police in Nigeria. go direct. There's a question down the front. Yeah.
Recently, in the last few days, Attorney General Robert McCann was reported as saying that the new government would work to make the, this is how it was recorded, the new terror legislation more friendly. Seems a contradiction to me, but do you have any idea how this is going to work, whether it's something that has already been put in place, and what it means for future investigations for potential terrorists?
Look, I'm aware of the report. I think we would all want less controversy surrounding the terrorism investigations, to let them be undertaken appropriately, and let the criminal justice system sort it out. Have confidence and faith in our criminal justice system, and it's the same with any crime. You know, if we abandon our criminal justice system, then we've taken the first steps away from good government and good governance. And I think all of us want less controversy surrounding these types of investigation, which is why we can't have public campaigns run in the media.
Question over there. Yes.
The title of your talk is Terrorism, Policing's New Paradigm. I'm wondering why and to what extent it is a policing paradigm, and whether it is perhaps to some extent more a defence paradigm, and where the debate might be at the moment.
Well, I guess it's up to our community as to how we want our terrorism matters to be dealt with. We have seen examples, and I make no comment on them, in other parts of the world where terrorism is treated as a military issue and not as a criminal justice issue, a civilian criminal justice issue. And I don't think we've reached the point here in Australia where we're abandoning our criminal justice system to actually deal with terrorism. And of course, the paradigm for us is, just as I explained, there's two aspects to the new paradigm. One is the preventative nature of what we've got to do. You know, you get a phone call, you might be from an international partner, they want you to do something. Do you do it or don't you do it? Who are you protecting, your relationship with the international partner, or are you protecting the Australian community? These are decisions that have to be made in a split second, so to speak. And the second part of it, as I just explained, is it is inherently political. We just need to learn to live with that. It's a different environment to what we've had with a murder or an armed robbery, where you don't have some of these complexities arising, particularly the international relationship side.
There's a question here, and then up the back. Yes?
That seemed, Commissioner Gully, to link with your earlier words about one aspect of the counter-terrorism laws are crime prevention. Could you develop whether or not there is a tension between that aspect of that counter-terrorism legislation and the rule of law, which you emphasise, including right to silence, presumption of innocence, and knowing the details of the charges against you? I see a tension there. If you're trying to prevent crime, then those aspects of the rule of the law might have to be abandoned, the way you phrase it. Am I right?
No. What I'm saying is that because of the inchoate nature of the crime that we're dealing with. In other words, if you were dealing with a break and enter, whilst the consequences of that crime affect perhaps one or a family of individuals if it was to be a house, I'm not condoning the crime, but I'm saying that if I was to stand up here and say we could prevent every break and enter in everybody's home in New South Wales for the next year, you would say I was an idiot, and I would be an idiot to say it. But there is an expectation that a terrorist act won't occur, that a terrorist act has a much wider implication, not only to the people immediately affected by a successful attack, but those people who are deterred from undertaking their day-to-day business because of the attack. Perhaps the best example I can give you of that are the thwarted attacks at Heathrow, with that almost were overlooked as quickly as they became part of our attention. And yet, if you can imagine the impact on our travelling public, and particularly to a country like Australia where we rely so heavily upon our aviation industry, had 9 747s fallen out of the skies because of bomb blasts over populated cities of the United States simultaneously, I recall, as many of you will, the crime scene for the Lockerbie disaster. It took years and years and years to reconstruct the crime scene, reconstruct the bomb, determine where the bomb was placed on the plane. And the UK authorities pursued that relentlessly over a number of years, and as we now know, Libyan terrorists were found to be the cause of that. Can you imagine, with all the security that we put at airports around the world, if a non-metallic object was used as the bomb-making device, which was the case with the thwarted Heathrow attacks? I'm not telling you anything that's not in the public domain. But to piece that all together, the actual impact of that is enormous. And therefore, not so much the pressure, but the expectation for us to get it right each and every time is, I think, much higher than with other crime types. And we accept that. We accept that responsibility. But we need to understand we're working with a new crime type, very high expectations. We don't want a terrorist attack here in our country, and we'll do our utmost to prevent that from happening.
Hang on. If you'd be brief, because a lot of other people here, okay?
I don't think he's answered the question.
Well, you think he hasn't, and he thinks he has. Okay. I think... Well, I'm not stopping you, but if everyone had three questions, we'd have two-thirds fewer than normal. Okay. Lynn Rolfe.
The success of any organisation is dependent on its people. You've got 6,000 and some of them are scattered around the globe. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about, how you're managing to recruit in a very low unemployment environment, what sort of people are coming to the AFP, and how do you maintain a really positive culture in a police force? Because that's often the challenge for the management.
And certainly, the profile of people joining the AFP is very different to many other police forces. The average age is 29. Over 70% have tertiary or postgraduate qualifications. So it is a different profile of people joining the organisation. We also have a large number of people who have previous police experience now coming to the organisation. This time last year, we had something like 3,500 people applying for jobs with the AFP online. In fact, we haven't had to have a broad recruitment campaign since I've been commissioner, which is almost 7 years now. Our recruitment has been for specific positions. As we expand further, we'll probably have to go into recruitment campaigns, but there is a high level of interest in the AFP because we do that community policing, national policing and international policing. It has a diversity of roles and it attracts a lot of interest. In terms of maintaining the focus of the organisation, it is a challenge, but we you know, we are dealing with some very high quality work. There are opportunities in our organisation that don't exist elsewhere, and that's a way of motivating people to continue to work for the organisation. And there is a high sense of responsibility and achievement when they do things for the Australian community, including things like the Bali bombings, things like serving in East Timor, things like serving in the Solomon Islands.
Next question. Lindsay Ellis.
There's a developing debate in America about the use of torture or the application of force in crime prevention as opposed to crime solving. Does the AFP or do you have a view on the use of that technique?
We don't support the use of torture, and we don't use torture, or we don't use any type of activity like that. Again, it goes back to the criminal justice system. Once we start to abandon the values of that system, then we're actually behind the eight ball, and other people, our adversaries, have made a step further, against good governance. And what we want to do is resist the temptation to go down those sort of paths as much as possible. Even with the new detention powers, it's got judicial oversight. It's not as if the AFP decides, on a whim that someone will be detained. If we do detain somebody, we have to immediately place them before a justice, and a justice has to oversight, a magistrate, oversight what we're doing there. And I think we're better off doing it that way. We're better off upholding our criminal justice system. If it fails us, then we try and address the problem. But so far it hasn't, and I don't see that it will. It certainly hasn't in the UK, that has a very similar justice system to our own. And I think we should be proud of our system of justice in this country.
Can I just ask, as you know, you enforce legislation, you're not responsible for enacting legislation, and I think the various national security legislation that went through in the last couple of years went through with bipartisan support from the coalition government, supported by the Labour Party in opposition. But as speaking as an AFP commissioner, are you broadly happy with what you've got, or would you want more, or could you do with less? What's your general feeling to the legislation?
I think for the time being we're very happy with what we've got. We've been able to work with what we've got. The control orders have worked. The detention orders have worked to the extent that they've been used. I think that the thing that we've learned in this environment is not to seek a grab bag of everything. We can't be the panacea for the world's problems. We're not going to stop terrorism in the world, but we can deal with the issues that confront the Australian community, and to that extent we have the powers that we need. And we don't need to abandon things like the right to silence or the presumption of innocence. We need to uphold those sorts of principles.
There's a question there, and then down here, and then over there. Yep. Yes. Yep. Yes.
Commissioner, you mentioned that all terrorist activity is directed towards political action. Is the overseas experience such that you find it's only federal or national governments that are attacked rather than local and regional governments?
Well, I think you've got to go back and look at the principles of Al-Qaeda and why Al-Qaeda does the things it does, why Jamar Islamiyah does the things it does. It is a global issue, and they are global issues that they are fighting. I don't want to go into Middle Eastern politics, but clearly the Middle East is at the heart of some of the things that we confront in terms of the ideals that have been embraced. The biggest challenge for us, and the biggest challenge, as I understand it, for our counterparts, particularly in the UK, is the notion of homegrown terrorism. And that's why it's so important to not marginalise or disenfranchise youth who are not involved in things in the Middle East. We don't want to give them the reason to embrace a cause, so to speak. It's one of the difficulties, and going back to the question about the paradigm, it's one of the difficulties of dealing with terrorism, because it's actually an idea, and in many ways an ideal that's being held, and you've got to make sure that you don't create the momentum or the reason to embrace or take on those ideals.
Michael Byrne.
Following up Gerard's question, are you content with the structures you have to deal with? For example, with the DPP, the relationship with the DPP, or the fact that in the federal court system there's a magistrate's court there's a federal court, but there's no equivalent of the district court. I mean, are you satisfied that that structure is appropriate, or should you look at situations where there should be, say, trial by jury or not trial by jury on in these matters?
Was it 7 o'clock tonight or tomorrow night? Look, until our own system fails us, we should stick to our system. Our system of courts, our framework for the separation of powers. We do have, as I mentioned to you, Sir Lawrence Street and former New South Wales Commissioner Ken Moroney and former Intelligence Director General Martin Brady, having a look at the interoperability between the intelligence agency and the AFP for our investigations work. There is a big difference between an intelligence operation and a police investigation. It's the outcome that's very different. One is a prosecution before a court of law in accordance with the principles we've discussed here tonight, and the other is a capacity to develop knowledge and understanding about an issue. And we want to make sure that the two are not mutually exclusive, but we also want to make sure that we can use them appropriately to protect the Australian community in whichever is the best fashion.
So come down here, then we go up there. Yeah?
Mr. Kilmeade, is it true that there's less problem of homegrown terrorists in the United States than in the UK and, say, France and other European countries? If that is true, I wonder why that would be. I don't know if it's true at all.
Certainly when I studied terrorism in the United States in 1993, in addition to the Middle East and South American terrorism, there was a significant amount of domestic terrorism that was being dealt with in the United States. You only have to look at some of the extreme groups that existed in the United States in the late 80s and mid to late 90s to understand that they do have a problem with domestic terrorism. They don't have a problem, as I understand it, in the same sense as the UK has, and part of that is I think, marginalisation of people in a community can give rise to, a much easier adaptation of radicalisation, and I know the Brits are doing everything they can to ensure that programs are in place to disabuse the people of the notion of that radicalisation will serve a purpose.
Christina Slade.
Commissioner, you said rather touchingly that you regretted, the passing of the police roundsman and the new media environment of opinion pieces, and you talked also about the problems with the new media environment, with the bloggers, with the Wikipedia and the like. I wonder if we just have to accept that this is the new media environment, and whether perhaps federal police might see themselves intervening in this new media environment, where after all everyone has their say. I mean, it's 10 years since it was called the Global Information Dumpster, and it is a very subtle and not impenetrable space. I mean, could you not use some of these new media environments to your own ends?
We do, and I understand the nature of the question too. Obviously, we're not going to stop. We're not going to stop the momentum of what's happened with information and the way information is transferred. In fact, without digressing and not answering your question, on a related issue, I talked in here about conspiracy. A conspiracy is an agreement to commit a crime or commit to a common purpose to commit a crime. When you look at the Dutch cartoons and you look at the speed with which so many people across so many different states were mobilised without necessarily, and in fact, I'm not aware of it, without any necessary communication to agree to do that, it shows you the significance of the information age and just how quickly issues can become quite significant. We're not going to prevent that. We are trying to work within the system, but the difficulty with the system is where people work outside the rules or the framework and who are not sanctioned or don't have a means by which to be sanctioned, then we have to call them to account, because we're quite happy with our own responsibilities and accountabilities, very happy with it. But I think, you know, we've just got to call a halt to criticising public institutions when it's the same public institutions that we rely upon to keep good governance, being the courts, not only the police, being the courts and being the investigations and the intelligence agencies, and a government should be allowed to govern for its mandate provided to it by its people.
There was just a verbal typo there, of course. Your reference was to the Danish cartoons.
Danish, yes, sorry.
I do it too often. Can I just, there's a question up there. Make the second last question. Yeah.
It's easy in reality, because no government and no minister of any persuasion has ever, in my term as a commissioner, has ever tried to influence any of the operations or activities of the AFP. But there is a close connection between what has to be done. You will recall the recalling of the Senate to change one word in the terrorism legislation. You might also recall it was after the changing of that word that the current charges that Gerard and I have talked about tonight against those people in Victoria and New South Wales were charged. So there has to be a connection. I mean, we can't operate independent of the policy makers. We have to contribute to policy making. And whilst there's a perception of being very close, there's a reality about how you deal with these issues, but we won't be influenced, and no one's ever tried to influence me or the AFP into getting an outcome in a political matter.
Just a final question. We know what policemen do on the beat, and you mentioned that earlier in relation to the media, but what does the commissioner of the AFP do? I mean, can you sort of talk us through what might be a typical day? It must be a very demanding day, but what...
Well, in addition to being Commissioner of the AFP, I'm also Chair of the Board of the Australian Crime Commission. The Board comprises each of the State and Territory Commissioners, the Head of ASIO, the Head of Customs and the Head of the Australian Securities Investment Commission. I also chair the Asia Pacific Group on Money Laundering, which is 32 countries in our region focused on money laundering. And I also sit here in New South Wales on the Board of the New South Wales Crime Commission. So in addition to my role, I have other roles to perform, and a typical day would involve a lot of travel. I travel frequently because of the international arrangements or the international involvement of the AFP in many matters. I also obviously spend a lot of time at Parliament House. So a typical day for me starts around 5 and finishes around 10 o'clock. And I've been doing that for 10 years, and I'm 7 years, and I'm still doing it. It feels like 10, 7 years. And to just to point out, I was appointed Deputy Commissioner in December 2000. I'm the shortest serving Deputy Commissioner in the police, because 3 months later I became Commissioner.
That explains my early on. I got a bit confused about the date. So, Commissioner, just stay there. I'll be very brief. I know there were more questions than I, but we always finish on time. So. And we're right on time. So as the Commissioner was saying, he's been in the top job since 2001, which has been an extraordinarily busy time for police forces throughout the world. It's been a very demanding time, and I think it's terrific and says a lot about our democracy and our legal system that the AFP Commissioner can give a public talk here and stand up and take half an hour of questions and discussion and answer questions and respond to an open debate. So I think that's terrific. Congratulations on your job. It's a difficult job, but congratulations on what you've done, and in particular thanks for coming along and speaking for us tonight. It'll be great when Anne publishes your paper in the Sydney Papers, be on our podcast tomorrow, but for tonight, many thanks. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.